Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here, talking about growing fruit in Wisconsin and some of the issues that can come along with it. Three guests for you today. Three UW Extension specialists, Amaya Atucha. She is a UW Extension fruit crop production specialist. Also an assistant professor of horticulture at UW-Madison. Pat McManus is UW Extension fruit crops plant pathologist, professor and chair of the Department of Plant Pathology. And Christelle Gadeau is UW Extension fruit crop entomology and assistant professor in the Department of Entomology. I should have said entomologist. But great to have them along. And welcoming them and welcoming you. And if you have some questions, I hope you'll join in as we talk fruits today on the show. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Post a photo of some fruit plants in your garden. We'd love to see those as well. And while you're on Facebook, be sure to go to the new Ideas Network page. And we've got a link on our Facebook page. For that, Amaya Atucha, welcome. Thanks for being with us again.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for inviting me.
Pat McManus, welcome to you.
Hi, Larry.
And Christelle Gadeau, thank you for coming back as well.
Hi, Larry. Thank you.
Lots of things we can talk about today. Patricia, let's start with you. And boy, the lines are all filled. But what effect has our cooler, wetter spring and then the summer, you know, some changes there, what's that had on our fruit crops?
Well, certainly for diseases, the summer, the very cool, wet summer was very conducive to diseases to the point where a number of fruit plants are defoliated or you just look at them and their leaves start dropping off. But, you know, so a fall cleanup is going to be important. I mean, we've had a little bit of a reprieve with the drier weather. The diseases have slowed down. But that has not killed off the pathogens. They live, they will persist over winter, and so a good fall cleanup, removing leaves, pruning trees, and getting rid of the brush and so forth, that will go a long way.
Yeah, I think so as well. Amaya, how about production? How's fruit production gone this year?
Well, there were a number of problems with berry crops. I've had many phone calls with raspberries that they were not ripening. I think it was mostly due to the wet spring that we had that slowed down things. We've also seen a lot of problems with apples cracking and pears cracking and small size fruit that it also has to do with the wet spring that basically slowed down the growth of those fruits. Those are the main problems that we have seen. Other than that, I would say that in terms of, you know, grapes, we have a great crop this year.
Good.
Very good crop. And yeah, those are the main problems this season.
Well, let's turn to Christelle Gadeau then. What about from your angle, what insects are causing problems right now, if any?
So right now is a good question because we still go back to our new invasive species that are being a major problem at this time of the year. The spotted wing Drosophila, I've talked about that in the past, but now is the time where they're really affecting our berry crops. So our raspberries or blackberries or blueberries. Blueberries are done now, but they're the crops that are being affected. And the populations are really building up and skyrocketing in August and September. So now is a time where you'll find a lot of maggots in your fruit. And so where a lot of management needs to happen, and prompt picking is going to be very important for people that are picking raspberries. There's actually a new publication on the UW Learning Store that we just put out on spotted wing. And if you look there and you type spotted wing Drosophila, or the name of the number of the publication is A4133. And there's a lot of information on there on what to do and how to identify and all of that. So that's one big problem right now. And then the brown marmorate sting bug is another one.
Yeah, that one has gotten to be a real pain.
Yeah, and you can see them now. So they're coming into houses now.
Yes, they are. Phyllis in Dunn, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Phyllis. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. So I have several fruit problems, and before I get cut off possibly, I want to know who could I hire to come out to my little orchard and give me advice?
So advice just in general?
Oh, well, I have apple trees that have, I don't know if it's disease or insects, but it's not really worth eating them. I have one pear tree where the fruit cracks and then turns black. And then one of my Asian pears has the insects depositing something. It makes dimples, and then there's worms in there.
Well, let's go to Christelle for that.
So I guess your best bet is to talk to your county agent there, your ag or horticulture agent in your county.
Okay.
That will be the first step to go and have them come out and look at the problems, and then we can help answer some of those questions. But that will be the first person that you would talk to that could come out and do a site visit and provide you with some answers, or look for those answers and contact us, and we can help you out with that, or other people can help out.
And Amaya, I heard you say earlier that the cracks on pears could well have been from the water or from the rain, that with the amount of rain we've had?
It's possible to have some cracks in the base of the pears, and it's due just, you know, water movement inside the fruit. Sometimes when you have a drought period followed by a very wet period or vice versa, you can have that influx of water into the fruit, very rapid influx of water, and that then the skin cannot extend, and then that's when you get the cracks.
That's not the problem here, because I've had it for years, and I've just been too busy to do anything about it. I've never had a single good pear from
another possibility is boron deficiency.
Oh.
So I would suggest that you send a foliar sample to the lab and look at boron. It's cracks in fruits are also related with boron deficiency.
Oh, so where would you, the plant disease diagnosis? No, you would send it to where?
You can send it to the UW Soil and Forage Lab, that is up in Marshville.
Okay.
So if you go to our website, we have a link. So our website is www.fruit.wisc.edu, and then you'll find in the menu on the right side, on the bottom right side, you'll find a link to the lab.
All right.
Okay, and what does it cost to have the county agent come out?
Nothing.
Wow.
Lucky you.
There you go, Phyllis. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Now, they may not be able, if you call them at 8 o'clock and say, hey, can you get here by 9 o'clock? you're probably not going to be in luck, Phyllis, but our extension agents do a really good job around the state, and they do their best to help out, so... Tim in Dewey Township, we go to you next. Hi, Tim.
Hey. Hi, Larry. Love your show.
Thank you.
I have a flowering crab that I got at the fairgrounds down 40 years ago. You know, DNR puts out some, you know, a bird attracting or wildlife attracting trees. That plant was about 10 inches tall. I stuck in the ground. Well, now it's about 20 feet high. And there is two outside the drip line. There's a couple little babies about 6 foot tall. I wonder if I can safely move them.
Oh, okay. Who wants to take that one? Let's go to Amaya.
So those are just suckers that are coming from the rootstock. So if you were to transplant them, you basically would not get the same variety cultivar that the crab tree is. It's whatever the rootstock is, which could be, you know, another species. And so then you would not have the same characteristics as the original tree. So if you don't want them there, if you want to propagate them, that's not...
No. I just want to move them.
You want to move them, or you want to remove them?
Move them, I think he said.
Move them over. Yeah.
Yeah, you can dig them and plant them somewhere else, but you're not going to have same plant, the same tree as where they're coming from, the vase.
So even 30 years ago, they were doing the roots, they were growing from the rootstock. So
they were grafting, yes.
They were grafting from a rootstock. So.
Yeah.
And the reason they do that is for hardiness, is it not?
No. The reason that we graft is because trees, just like, you know, animals, they go through different phases of development. So you have a juvenile phase in which you don't produce any flowers, and then you have mature material in which you already start producing, you know, flowers, and you can have fruit. So if you start a plant from a seed, you're going to have to go just like a child through infancy and then puberty and then until you are mature. Well, the trees are the same thing. However, when you graft mature tissue on juvenile tissue, then that mature tissue is able to start producing flowers in a span of maybe like 3 to 5 years. And so that's the reason why we graft, is to start production early on. In addition to that, there's a number of benefits that you can get from rootstocks, like, you know, if you have a problem with your soil or soil pH, or you have a disease, you can use that rootstock to overcome some of those problems.
Yeah, excellent answer. As you talked about kids, I was thinking there are probably some parents once in a while that wouldn't mind grafting their kids. Oh, thanks, Tim, for calling. Appreciate
that
your call.
There will be different guests who will talk about that.
I guess so. Julia in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Julia.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. We have a dwarf plum tree, and it looks like this summer it was infected with black knot fungus, and that's pretty sad to me. And I'm just curious what we should do about it and what are the chances of saving the tree.
Okay.
Pat, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at that one. So black knot is, this summer, did you see the black knots themselves or just swollen stems?
The black knots.
Okay.
That was confusing.
Yeah, so that's means that it's actually been there for a year anyway. So it's kind of a long, slow disease where it infects 1 year and you get some swelling of the twigs and the branches, but then the following year is when the fungus starts causing the black look to it. Unfortunately, other than just pruning out the knots, there's not a lot that you can do. And I realize on a young dwarf tree, there's not a lot of plant there, and so you start pruning away, and you're going to be disfiguring the tree. But a little bit of work has been done on fungicides, and so if you're not opposed to spraying a fungicide, you might try to go to a garden store and see if you could find some Captan. That would be probably one of the better fungicides. Sulfur might have a little bit of activity as well, but I would give Captan a try if you can find it. But pruning, and then when you prune, you have to make your pruning cuts a little bit below the visible symptoms, because the fungus is inside the tissues and isn't just where you see those black knots, but also about 4 to 6 inches away. So that might, and like I said, on a small tree, I know that's going to disfigure it quite a bit, but that's about all you can do.
There we go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Let's go to Norman in Wausau next. Norman, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry. I got two questions for your experts there. One is, we have three varieties of plums, and one of them, black ice, has split about two-thirds of the plums, while our Alderman and our Stanley's hardly split at all. And the second question I have is, we have a Cortland apple tree among many, but it's about 40 years old, and for the last 3 years, it's had few apples and very small ones, and I don't see any reason for it that I can think of.
Okay. Well, let's see. Let's go to Amaya. Do you want to start there?
So the plum, the fruit splitting, and I think I just comment on somebody else's question before, it's mostly due to just erratic watering. Just phases of having a lot of water and heavy rains combined with you know, some weeks where it's very dry, which is the case right now, that is dry. So that is very common to see on stone fruits. Regarding the Cortland apple tree, so did you have fruit before?
Oh, yes, and some nice big fruit and a lot of them on the tree over the years. But for some reason, the last 3 years, it just, like, it's retiring.
Yeah.
Do you have another apple tree or crab trees around there that can work as pollinizer?
Yes. I have a Whitney crab right next to it, and I have a another variety right next to it, too.
How old did you say that tree was, roughly?
About 40 years old.
Wow. Yeah.
So here's another question. Did you have a big crop last year? No, you said 3 years in a row, no crop.
Well, we do get some apples, but they're small and few.
Yeah.
So here's one possibility, is that in the last year we had a late spring frost. So my question here is, like, do you have flowers but you don't have fruit, or you don't see any flowers?
We do have the flowers.
Okay.
Don't get the fruit.
So the problem here is a fruit set problem. So one reason could be just frost events, like last year, the late spring frost, that could have wiped out most of the fruit. And then, you know, the question is more maybe some sort of, you know, disease or lack of pollen that is affecting the fruit set, because you have the flowers. If you were not to have flowers, then I would think about some other reasons why that tree is not producing flowers. But given that you have flowers every year, you're just not setting fruit. That makes me wonder whether, you know, the other trees that you have as pollinizer are really providing enough pollen, or whether you're having a cold event that might be damaging the flowers that are not setting any fruit. Micronutrient deficiency might be an explanation, but it's very rare, and you would see a lot of pattern of micronutrient deficiency on the foliage.
Would pruning have any impact on this?
Pruning will have an effect on flower production, so that's why I ask whether there were flowers or not. But given that there are flowers, that is not the cause.
Pat, do you have something to add to that?
Well, the only thing that comes to mind would be sometimes in older perennial plants, viruses find their way in, and they remain latent for many years. They're just there, but they don't do much. But then eventually they take their toll. So certainly in raspberries, that's very common. And apples, I hear about it less. But you know, commercially, we don't have too many orchards that have 40-year-old trees. But so that's a possibility. A plant will not recover from a virus. So so that's about the only thing I can think of from a disease standpoint. I did want to make a comment about the splitting. So of plums, of grapes, various fruits, if they've had powdery mildew goes to leaves, but will also get on the fruit, and it infects the skin. And so then when the fruit tries to expand, the powdery mildew will make it stiff, not very flexible. And so sometimes you can get splitting worse if powdery mildew is present as well.
Yeah.
Certainly on grapes, it's very, very common.
Given the kind of spring and the wet, we probably powdery mildew was fairly active around the state, wasn't it, Pat?
Yeah, actually, powdery mildew, I mean, some plants get it no matter what the conditions are. But powdery mildew is an interesting disease in that it can develop even without a lot of free water. But what we've had, though, in these past few weeks in a lot of the state is actually drier weather.
Yeah.
And so powdery mildew, and powdery mildew tends to come up later in the season anyway. And so it's really come on strong on grapes and stone fruits and so forth. So
there we go. Thanks a lot, Norman, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Our guests, Amaya Atucha, Patricia McManus, and Christelle Godeau, all from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Jill Nadeau, our producer here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Next week, on next Friday on Garden Talk with a vegetable and soil specialist, we'll be talking about fall cleanup and composting, so I hope you can join us for that. Right now, taking a look at our Wisconsin fruits with our guests, Amaya Atucha, Patricia McManus, and Christelle Godeau from the UW-Madison. Great to have them along, and thanks so much for joining us today. Joe in Eau Claire has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hey, good morning. So I just put in a new planter in the front of our house to hide our garage, and the wall behind where I'm hoping to plant some trees is about 35 degrees towards the west off of True North, and I get sun at about 11 o'clock, 12:30 in the morning, consistently, or this time of year, and it's better when the sun's higher in the earlier in the season.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, how many hours of sun do I really need to have a productive fruit tree once it gets up past the heights, that 6 foot, 7 foot height of shadow of the building?
Yeah.
Do you know how to, you get what I'm asking?
I think so. Amaya, do you want to take that?
So I would say that around 6 hours of light would be good enough.
Would be good enough.
Yeah.
Okay. And since I've got you, I got to ask one more question. I live within 3 miles of 4 apple orchards. I do not want to grow apples because I can get them everywhere. Is there another fruit that I've heard people talking about nectarines, peaches, and stuff like that, they're actually getting away growing them up this far north. Is there a grapefruit that I could grow that I can't buy or that's not readily accessible?
Well, there's a lot of people experimenting. I mean, if you're just going to plant one tree or two trees, is fine. We don't really recommend to have an orchard of peaches up there. You can try a couple of peach trees. I think that Contender is one of those varieties that seems to be working. I've heard a couple of homeowners saying that they've been able to produce some peaches out of that. You could also have some pears, or Asian pears might also work. There could be, I think that honeyberry is another one that people have been interested in. And we have a good publication on that in one of our newsletters from Professor Up in UW River Falls, Brian Smith, who put some varieties. And that's something that you might not be able to get at a grocery store.
And honeyberry is getting popular.
Mm-hmm. Honeyberry pears?
No, honeyberries are just
a type of berry.
A type of berry, exactly.
A type of
it's
berry.
Like a elongated blueberry.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Carrie in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What have you got for us today?
Well, I've planted two apple trees in my yard, and I want to train them in the espalier style. And I'm kind of looking for some advice on the structure to support the beginning of it, and then also where to make that initial cut to create the lateral branching.
Yeah. So can you describe for us, Maya?
That is a not very common training system for production, so I'm not very familiar with it. It looks very nice. It's basically what you have is it's a tree that has multiple sort of cordons and it extended and it needs some support, like either a trellis or you can have it on a wall, and it looks very pretty. You just have lateral branches at different heights that go horizontally, so when it blooms you have this beautiful shaped tree with all these beautiful white bloom. So it looks great, but it's complicated. To you need to have some basic knowledge about how to get the trees there. So I'm not very familiar with it, but what I do know is that you will need some sort of trellis for that, and so that's the first thing to look at, some trellis structure or even a wall where you can lay those branches that has enough support. I'm sorry that I don't have much answers about this, but I would definitely just try to look it up on the internet. I'm not an expert. I would think that the first cut, if you have, if a grafted tree of a specific variety, make sure that you're making the cut at least 2 to 3 inches over the grafting unions. And make sure that you have some buds there, so you can see those as you look at the tree and the bark. You'll see where those buds are, and you want to leave at least 3 to 4 buds just to make sure that you're going to have enough branching.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. If anybody's got a photo of that, I'd love to see that up on the Facebook page. If you've got a photo of that method, espalier, is it pronounced? Is that how it's called? Espalier?
Espalier, but I do not know what it means in French either. So.
There you go. All right, let's go to Tim in Eau Claire. Tim, what's on your mind?
Well, my question is probably going to seem like blasphemy to your guest, but I am a woodworker, and I absolutely love working with wood burls. They are quite expensive, so my thought was, why not grow them instead of particularly trying to grow apples or cherries, trying to grow burls on apple trees or cherry trees? So I'm wondering if they know of anybody who's done this, had any success, or if they had any wild guesses as to how it would be a good way to do it.
I like the idea of the wood. The apple or the cherry would make some pretty burls for sure. Well, Pat McManus, what do you think?
Well, I like the way that you've posed the question. I think you have low expectations of getting a super sound answer here. That is something I have not heard of anyone trying to intentionally produce burls. I suspect the reason that they are valuable is because they are I know they're rare, and because you can't readily propagate it. That's my suspicion. But you know, a few diseases cause abnormal growth, and whether it's technically what turns out to be a burl or not, I guess I'm not sure. Unfortunately, I don't know how you would
inject the disease.
Bring on these diseases. Yeah, a crown gall is one that comes to mind, and that's a very common disease on a number of plants, woody plants, and even herbaceous plants, where you get large swelling. It's induced by a soil-borne bacterium that gets into the plant, and then after a while, the tree itself just starts producing the growth without the bacterium there. The bacterium actually genetically transforms the plant to do that. So Agrobacterium tends to enter particularly through winter injury. So the problem with that, though, is that your tree could very well die, and it wouldn't live long enough for you to get a nice big burl. There are a couple of other fungi, rust fungi, on apple in particular. I'm not thinking of any other pathogen. I'm trying to think on cherry, and nothing's really coming to mind. I'm just, there are some rust fungi of pines that cause burls, but I'm sorry, I don't...
That's as far as we can go with that. And there wouldn't be insects. Would there be insects involved, Christelle?
For burls per se, I don't know. There are insects that can cause galls to form, but I don't know that would be something that would be very common in apple trees, like causing burls that you would be looking for. There also is mechanical injury and abiotic factors that can cause things like that, but to really intentionally do it, I have no idea how you would do that. There could be beetles that could infest the tree, and cause burls, but none that I know. Really.
Yeah. And so the problem is, for somebody like our caller, you can try these things, but then you got to wait around for a long, long time to see the results. That would be...
And if you have the wrong insect or the wrong pathogen, then you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
But it'd be really cool, and you could make a lot of money if you could figure out a way to do it.
Yeah. That is a very cool idea.
Keep us posted.
Yeah. If you figure something out, let us know. Tim in Muskego, on to you now. Hi, Tim.
It's Jim. Good morning, everyone.
Oh, sorry, Jim.
I have a question. That's quite all right. Regarding my blueberry plants that I just put in this past spring, in Waukesha County here, we have a lot of clay and rocks, and I dug down 14 inches in a 4-by-10-foot area and then did a raised bed. Added through the mixes I've studied, what I felt would be a good mix of peat moss and perlite and sand and all that kind of thing. And the plants are doing well, except they're, and this happened in the summer, they're very mahogany red. And I'm wondering if that's because, by the way, I had my soil tested. It was at 6.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, is that normal during the summer to have really, really mahogany red leaves on them? They're 3 different varieties.
So, no, it's not normal. And so there's a couple of things that could be happening. One thing that might turn the leaves, purple-reddish could be magnesium and phosphorus deficiency. So I would recommend you to take a soil sample and send it to the lab for test. That is one reason.
For those specific things, yeah.
If you take it, basically you send for a standard foliar test, and it will give you all of the nutrients, the major nutrients.
I did that before I had the plants in the ground. So I did have that done.
But that was soil. This is foliar, so you will take leaves and send them to the lab. In our website and our newsletter, we do have the standards of what are the ranges, the normal ranges of concentrations of these nutrients for blueberries. The other reason could be, and I'm going to pass it to Patty, is Phytophthora.
So Phytophthora is a soil-borne fungus, and blueberries fairly susceptible. So if there was ever any standing water, or if the soils are heavier, leaves will turn red. I mean, it's just a stress response.
Okay.
And how that might be corrected, if you have heavy soil, it's going to be tough. But if you could, if the plants aren't, you know, if you can actually get in and amend the soil a bit.
Which I did. Which I did this spring.
Oh, you did.
I mean,
it's
completely, that old soil's totally gone.
Okay.
This is, you know, peat moss for good drainage, et cetera. They seem to be doing well. I picked all the flowers off. They did flower this spring. You know, first year I wanted just the plants to grow. But it just seems kind of odd that, and I can see it follow the vein, and eventually the whole leaf, you know, gets it. So,
yeah, interesting.
So those would be the two first options that I would look at. It's either you look at some nutrient deficiency, and you would see the pattern on some varieties tend to be more sensitive to nutrient deficiencies than others. The other thing that would be is just to dig around the root system and just look at some of those roots to see if they're white or they're turning brown or black.
Okay.
That could be also a sign of some fungal infection.
Yeah,
and you could submit a sample to the Disease Diagnostic Clinic here in Madison, and Phytophthora is something that they look for all the time in dying plants, so quite familiar with it.
Yeah,
worth it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Tim, for calling. Appreciate it. Chris in Baraboo, it's your turn. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Larry. I appreciate the show.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I have several different fruit trees, two apples, two peach, and a plum, and I've got grapevines. And a couple of years ago, I got clobbered by the Japanese beetles. Just they actually killed one of my grapevines. And then this year, and they always go after like birch trees and the apple trees. And this year, they just clobbered the prune or the pears. I'm sorry, the plum tree got just decimated. I'm wondering, is there a special insecticide for orchards that would take care of Japanese beetle?
That's a little bit tougher. Perhaps, Christelle Gadeau, what about it?
So, yes, Japanese beetle are definitely a problem. This year was a very bad year for Japanese beetle. We had very, very high numbers. And as you know, they're very strong flyers. So the problem you have is that if you apply an insecticide, it will kill the insects that are on the plant that you're trying to protect. But there's new insects that are coming in. So we have insecticides. I guess the best one I would recommend is 7. It's one of those broad-spectrum insecticides, but that's one that will provide probably the best control. It's not the only one, but all of them are pretty much broad-spectrum insecticides. Hopefully, you need to have some residual activity so that the new insects that are coming in are not attacking those plants. There's also some preventative treatments that you can do to try to get to the larvae before they emerge. And so there's things you can apply to the soil, and you would look at that at a garden store for what you can apply. There's a publication, a fact sheet on the Plant Diagnostic Clinic, where it has information for homeowners of what you can do for Japanese beetle. And it talks a little bit about that, the preventative soil treatments that you would do for the larvae. But it's a tough insect.
Yeah.
I put milky spores down 2 years ago, and it seemed to have taken care of it last year, but for some reason this year didn't help.
So the problem with milky spore and a lot of those organic treatments that a lot of people are talking about, neem oil and those kind of things, is they're very inconsistent in providing results that show that they're really efficacious. So the milky spore, the research is not showing that they work well. That works well. It has to build up in the soil for a very long time, and so there's not like definitive evidence that it works. But it wouldn't work the year you apply it. So okay. I would not necessarily recommend that.
All right. There we go. Great. Thanks a lot for calling, Chris.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Appreciate the call. And Vivian in Door County, on to you now. Hi, Vivian.
Good morning, everyone. I just wanted to say you were talking about the woman, I don't know if this is the right word, espalier, the lateral pruning of trees or training the trees. And I just wanted to say that at the Chicago Botanic Gardens, in Illinois, a beautiful display at their visitor center. You come right to the
just an incredible display of that method of pruning. And also throughout the garden at various other places against the walls, they have that type of training. And I think that you can get information from their horticulturist there about so that method.
At the Chicago Botanical Garden.
That's right.
All right. Perfect. Thank you so much, Viv.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You as well. Thank you, Vivian. And Janet in Oak Creek up next. Hi.
Oh, good morning or afternoon, whatever it is right now. I just wanted to make a comment for the caller who wanted some alternative fruit tree. He might want to research the pawpaw. This is the second year that I'm getting fruit, and it is a unusual tree. Mm-hmm. It grows as an understory, or it can be grown as an understory, and it's got beautiful tropical leaves, with or without the fruit. It's a lovely tree, and I did try trees are producing fruit. Last year I tried it for the first time, and they are very, very sweet, and they describe it like a banana custard, and I can say it does taste very, very much like banana custard.
Well, I tell you what, Amaya Atucha is nodding in agreement on that, Amaya.
Yeah, that is actually a really good suggestion. Pawpaws are cold hardy. They produce fruit early on. You do have to have two different varieties to pollinate each other. They also require a good spot with sunlight. And there was a question before, at least 6 hours of sun and light during the day. And as I say, they're hardy. They produce delicious fruit. It's an acquired taste for some people. They have sort of a special kind of like volatile aftertaste. I think they're delicious. Different varieties taste different. Cornell has a great selection of varieties. So if you go to their website, you can probably find a lot of varieties that they're hardy for, at least New York State, which I think is the closest that we can get. Here for Wisconsin. So yes, that is actually a very good alternative.
Thank you, Janet. Appreciate your call. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Amaya Atucha, Pat McManus, excuse me, and Christelle Godot, our guests, all with the University of Wisconsin-Madison in their respective departments of horticulture, plant pathology, and entomology. Our guests on Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Talking Wisconsin fruits today with our three guests. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way, but if you have insect questions or disease questions or just general production questions about our Wisconsin fruits, I hope you'll join us. Number to call 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page. Let's go to John in Shiocton next. John, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. In regard to the lady that was asking about the espalier style of growing fruit trees.
Yeah.
I live in Green Bay, but I have an orchard out northwest of Shiocton, and I have about 50 trees trained like that. And what I do, one of the things that's important is either you get a dwarf or a semi-dwarf rootstock. You don't want a standard, because you will fight the growth on that tree forever. You can't use a regular standard fruit tree. I train my first lateral at 18 inches, 36 inches, 48 inches, and then at 60 inches, because I don't need a ladder to prune and I don't need a ladder to pick fruit. And when you train these, you just want to put one tier on a ear. So if she gets something that's like a whip, she can set her first line. And what I used for the lines, I used metal fence post, and then I put 9-gauge electric wire for making electric fences.
Yep.
I put 9-gauge wire on there, and then I train those along that 9-gauge wire. Once the branch gets some heft to it, they don't need much support anymore. And when she wants to add a tier, you only clip it about an inch above the wire itself, because it'll sprout then, and then you can start training that when they're young. And the following year, you go to your tier two, and after 4 years, you should be all the way to the top. And it works really good. The other thing is, it works good for apples and pears. It does not work good for stone fruits like plums, peaches, things like that.
Yep.
It won't work for that.
It sounds really cool. Have you got a photo of your orchard?
I'd have to dig one up. What I did was, because we have so many deer out there, I built a chain link fence enclosure, and then I thought, well, how can I make the most use of this? So I put the espalier all the way around the four sides of my fence, and then I moved it in about a foot, put up the other fence posts, and that's where I have them trained. So I have a wall all the way around my nursery that's made out of apple and pear trees that are trellised like that with four tiers on them. And in the center of my orchard, I still have plenty of room to use it. It works, and for spraying, it's really nice because you walk on the inside, walk on the outside, and you got it all done.
Wow, you should go out there with your smartphone and take a photo and send it to our Facebook page. I would love to see a photo.
Okay. The other thing is it requires a lot of summer pruning to help it set fruit, but you actually get more apples per leaf count because the exposure to the sun is more.
Yeah.
And that works out really well. And then I had your other lady, I heard your other person talking about pawpaw. I also have pawpaw that I grow in Green Bay. And this year my tree's loaded. I got a couple trees there. This year I had really good luck with it. One of the things that helps with the fruit production on there is, I don't know, they're native to southeastern United States because they call it the Kentucky banana, and it does kind of taste like banana custard, and it's got a really good texture to it. But sometimes you have to hand pollinate to get a better production, and I do have two varieties, and I cross-pollinate it. I don't know if there's an insect in the region they're native to. I don't know if they're insect pollinated. They're not wind-borne pollination. So you get a bigger crop if you take like a little model paintbrush and you go into the flowers. The flowers look like bells when they're ripe as far as creating the pollen and the stamen.
Yeah.
And you can go in there and gather that and go between the trees every morning and just wipe it around in there like you're cleaning out your ear with a Q-tip. And that really ups the production of the fruit. And that fruit in this climate gets ripe into October. It'll get kind of green pods on it, maybe 4 to 6 inches long, might weigh a half a pound a piece. It's a green rind on the outside, but it'll start turning little brown spots on it. And then you go up and you pinch it with your fingers. If it's slightly dense, it's ripe. Otherwise, it's not ripe yet.
Yeah. Well, lots of good information there, Amaya.
Yeah, the pollination is true. Actually, that's a practice that is done on commercial production of chirimoya, which is the tropical version of the pawpaws. And what you can do is also collect some of the pollen and mix it with some flour that has sort of like the same texture and the same grade as the pollen, and you can put in some like spraying bottle and then spraying into the flowers. And that's actually something that is done. It's very labor intensive. In a commercial scale, it's actually done in some places in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, you can do that, but it's right. If you want to have a higher production, collecting some of that pollen and hand pollinate them with either a brush or some device that you can use to just spray. You can augmentate it with, as I said, with like cornstarch or with flour, and then you get more volume of that pollen.
Makes good sense. John, thanks a lot. And by all means, get a photo and post it up on our Facebook page. I'd love to see it.
And of the pawpaws, too.
Yeah, of the pawpaws, too. Thank you very much for calling. All right. Well, here's Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota, next with a question or a comment. Hi, Pam.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have three pear trees. I have two females and one male, and they're gorgeous in the spring when they bloom. But my one pear is red, and it seems like the deer have gotten those since I planted them. My other tree just started with fruit this year, and since when we buy pears, they're green and cold when we buy them. So I'm wondering, at what point do I know they're ready to pick? I picked a few just to see what they do, and I didn't know whether to refrigerate them, but I didn't, and forgot to look at them for a couple of days. A couple of them had gone a little too ripe. So that's my question. At what point do I know that they're ready to pick?
Yeah, it could be kind of tricky in a way. Yeah.
There's a very easy way. It's not by color or by texture or anything like that. You just go to the tree, hold the fruit in your hand, and you tilt it horizontally. If the fruit detaches easily, it's ready. If not, it's not ripe yet.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling. I use the bite method myself. I've got a friend, neighbor who's got a pear tree.
And it should be after that, after they're picked, you can leave them at room temperature for at least a week until they are actually soft and ready to consume.
Yeah. I can tell you right now, if you just pull one off the tree and take a bite, it's not ready most of the time. That's for sure. Mark in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning. I have a question. I have access to chestnuts through several trees in town, and I'm wondering, is it possible to grow trees from seeds like that, or the nuts, I should say? And if you can, do you have any tricks or any ideas?
Yeah.
Are these chestnut trees ornamental, or are you hoping to produce chestnuts?
To produce chestnuts.
Okay.
I was going to try to maybe put them on my hunting land and see what they would do there.
Okay, if you are going to plant them from seeds, you can get seedlings. I've been asked a lot about chestnuts, so actually I researched it. So I'm going to tell you what I found. I found that Michigan State University has a great website. It's www.chestnuts.msu.edu. They have a ton of information. And they have actually there some resource or nurseries where you can buy either seedlings or grafted chestnut trees with different varieties. So that's a good place to start. There are some hybrids between European and Japanese and European and Chinese chestnuts, and there's also Chinese cultivars, and some of them come grafted and some of them are seedlings. So,
but if you're going to do it from seeds, I hope you're a young man.
I've got access to buckets and buckets of chestnuts, and I thought, well, I could just throw them out and hope the squirrels do their job, or if I could actually try to, you know, put them in pots, let them sit outside for the winter and literally grow them. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah.
I've never tried it, but I don't see why it wouldn't work. It might need some treatment. The seeds might need some scarification or some sort of previous treatments to be able to germinate. But I'm not an expert, and I would definitely recommend you to go to the Michigan State University website. They have a really good resource there and a lot of information about how to start and what to do and how to choose cultivars if you want to go that route.
So what's the site again? Is it?
It's www.chestnuts.msu.edu.
Ah, there you go. Chestnuts.msu.edu. And there you go. Thanks, Mark. Jean in Sauk, your turn. Hi, Jean.
Hi, how are you, Larry?
Great, appreciate the call.
Thank you. I hope I have a relevant question. I'm like the person who bought tulips in fall and didn't, you know, I didn't plant them until spring. I bought some day-neutral strawberry roots in spring, and I've just found them under my carrots. Well, fall is clean-out time, so I'm wondering, do they go to the compost or plant them in the ground? Do I have a hope?
No.
Yeah, well, no.
I don't think you're going to be very successful.
Unfortunately, you're not way north, but even so, Sauk is... It's going to be a problem.
It's going to be cold. They will not establish properly. Some of them might take off.
You know what, Gene? What do you got to lose? I'd stick them in the ground and see what happens.
Yeah. I would not be very optimistic, but who knows? If we have maybe a long, warm fall, they might be able to establish and produce some roots and be able to survive the winter. What happens is that if you keep them for very long in the refrigerator, they just consume all of their reserves just by trying to survive in that environment. So they have very little reserves, and so then you plant them in a very short fall, and they are sort of this weak plant that doesn't have enough time to be able to settle in that space and to produce new roots and uptake nutrients and produce enough reserves to survive the winter. So you kind of like planting sort of like an already sort of like sick plant. It's not sick with a disease, but it's not very strong. So if we have a long fall, you might be able to make them survive until spring. But I don't know. I wouldn't be very optimistic, but give it a try.
Okay, I have some good soil. Could I plant them kind of close together and see what happens and then move them out in the spring?
Sure.
Yes, you could.
Okay, I'll give it a shot, but I don't want to waste all my good planting bed for something that isn't going to grow.
Well, yeah, you could plant them close to the house, maybe.
Yeah, I got a new bed next to the house with all kinds of horse manure in it and everything.
Well, that would be a good spot to, if it's next to the house. I mean, it keeps the soil keeps a little warmer there. I've got some plants.
Yeah, if you can protect them during the winter, that would definitely help.
I've got a few plants that shouldn't be living, but do because they're close to the, they're right next to the house, and I think they get a little help from the warmth of the house in our colder weathers. Well, I tell you what, Amaya Atusha is a UW Extension fruit crop production specialist and an assistant professor of horticulture at UW-Madison. Patricia McManus is a UW Extension fruit crops plant pathologist, professor, and chair in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. And Christelle Godot, assistant professor in the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison and fruit crop entomologist and extension specialist. Our three guests here on Garden Talk. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking Wisconsin fruit crops today with our three guests, Amaya Atusha, Extension Fruit Crop Specialist and Assistant Professor of Horticulture, Patricia McManus, Pat's a UW Extension Fruit Crops Plant Pathologist, Professor and Chair of the Department of Plant Pathology, and Christelle Godot, who is a UW Extension fruit crop entomologist from the Department of Entomology, all three from the UW-Madison. Great to have them along. We are going to turn right back to the phones for Mary in Bellevue next. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. For 20 years, I've successfully raised blueberries, but this year I lost a crop to maggots. What can I do to prevent this happening next year?
So blueberry maggots, and let's turn to Christelle Godot.
Hi, Mary. Thank you for your question. I guess when I was seeing the question, I thought it was blueberry maggot, and I'm glad to hear your question because it's a very different species that you probably have as a problem there. I would suspect that you have what's called spotted wing Drosophila that we talked about very briefly earlier. It affects blueberries and other small fruit crops like that. And if you have a lot of them, it would be spotted wing Drosophila because blueberry maggot is a new species for Wisconsin from a year ago. So I was going to answer on blueberry maggot, but really I think you have spotted wing. So you have a lot of larvae in your fruit, a lot of maggots. Is that correct?
Every blueberry has several.
So yeah. That's spotted wing Drosophila. So what you can do, you have a big patch or?
I have 16 plants, and they're inside a patch, yeah.
Okay. Your best bet is, from a sanitation standpoint, is going to be to pick your fruit promptly. Because those flies will attack fruit that's barely ripening and ripe. So you have to pick them quickly and refrigerate them. It won't kill them, but there's no issue in eating berries that have either eggs or very small larvae. You won't see them. You won't know they're there. So that's your best bet from like just a sanitation or cultural control method. And then removing ripe fruit that's infested or dropping to the ground. Because those flies develop very fast and will lay a lot of eggs. Then if you really have a problem, you're going to have to resort to insecticides. And you're going to have to spray pretty much on a 5 to 7 day basis until you're done with harvest. It's a very devastating pest.
So I start spraying when?
So you would, best is to monitor by using traps. You can make your own trap, and we have a lot of information on our website, that fruit.wisc.edu on that insect. But you want to monitor once you have a fly. The detection level is one fly, and your fruit is turning red, you need to start spraying insecticides.
What would you advise?
So if you want to stay organic, and Trust is the best insecticide you want to spray, the problem is they have a high potential for resistance to that spinosad, that active ingredient. So you want to rotate it maybe with some Paganic, and those should be available at a garden store. Another one, I don't know if it's available, is Grandevo. But I don't know if it's easy to find at the garden store yet because it's newer. But those
I'm
would
sorry,
be your...
Say that name again.
Okay, so the main one is Entrust. That's the one that carries all the weight on your insecticide activity.
Uh-huh.
Then you want to rotate that every other week with Pyganic. That you can find at the garden store. And Grandevo, so Grand, and EVO at the end. But I'm not sure that it's available commercially. I mean, for a garden store. I know it's available for commercial growers, but... Mm-hmm. And then there are a lot of other insecticides that would not be organic. But those are the only options on organic that work.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. Margaret in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. I enjoy your show very much. I have been listening, and I haven't heard anyone mention apricots. Now, we have a farmer here who raises apricots, and I always wait till his sign goes up to hurry over and get some because they are delicious, and they can be raised in this far north. Now, I like them fresh, but also I take the apricots, cut them in half, remove the pit, put a drop of honey in each half, and then dry them in a very slow oven, and they are delicious.
Ooh.
So I think, you know, someone should think about maybe raising more apricots.
Wow. But, you know, there are some problems with raising apricots, aren't there, Amaya?
Yes, there are. And Margaret, it's because you are in Sturgeon Bay, which is protected by the lake.
Yeah.
So the winters are milder, the springs are milder as well. You have less spring frost, and the trees, the apricot trees, suffer less. We do not recommend planting apricot trees any other places. Sturgeon Bay might be a possibility close to the to the lake as well, just because of the effect of the lake in just helping raise a little bit the temperature in the middle of the winter and in the fall, and so that helps the trees survive. But it's hard to grow apricots. It's people are not going to be very successful unless they are, as I said, close to the lake. So we do have in one of our publications, it's called Home Fruit Cultivars for Southern Wisconsin. It's the A2582 publication. You can find it at the UW Extension Learning Store. We do have some varieties there that we recommend. But as I said, I mean, it's a very specific place where you can successfully grow apricots.
So, Margaret, you're going to have to talk the neighbors all around that apricot tree into growing apricots because they're in the right spot. Oh, man.
Even more.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Wisconsin Rapids, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. First, I have a comment. The gentleman that was trying to grow chestnuts from seed, we've been pretty successful doing that on some hunting land in western Wisconsin, and it's fairly simple. Put them in the fall, probably about 2 inches deep, and let nature stratify them over the winter, and you should get germination the following spring. So I've also grown them in a nursery setting with the same type of setup, maybe a garden type arrangement, and they come up good fall seeding, and they will naturally stratify and scarify out and germinate the following spring. So he could try that. But I have a question. I have about 30 apple trees, different varieties, over in western Wisconsin that got hit real hard by a hailstorm this June.
Oh.
They were probably 1 inch to 2 inches in diameter, just starting to go into production, and they experienced some pretty significant stem and branch wounds, damage. The leaves were stripped. They seem to be callusing over the majority of the wounds. I'm just wondering if you had an opinion on what the prognosis of those trees might be in the future, if you think they'll heal up or they're going to be susceptible to insect and disease infestations, and what we might have to do to care for them.
Yeah. Pat, you want to start with that?
Yeah, I'll share with you something that happened at the Peninsula Research Station a few years ago. It was 2014, I think. People from Sturgeon Bay area would know, probably remember this event, where they had a very severe hailstorm. It was about July 7th, about the second week of July. where they actually brought out snow plows to remove some of the hail. And so we actually had an intern living at the research station there, and he thought it was the apocalypse. It was quite amazing. It lasted for about a half an hour. The trees were just stripped bare, the grapevines likewise. And they did go out with fungicides afterwards to protect the wounds, and fungicides that were registered for use on those crops and at that time of year. And the plants recovered quite well. The fruit was a total loss. By the end of the year, the grapevines looked like nothing had happened. They didn't have fruit. But so I think the prognosis is probably pretty good. If you do start seeing cankers develop, and it's obvious that you have an infection, you know, you might notice that next summer, you know, right. take those out, because they're only going to be a problem and they'll be a source of fungus to infect other places. But I'd give them a chance.
Spraying with a fungicide it'd be necessary to do that on a pretty regular basis, wouldn't it, to be effective every couple, 3 weeks?
The trees, after they start healing over. I guess I don't remember what they did at the Peninsular Station, but the really critical one is the one of just as soon as you can get out there after the hailstorm. But it's trees are pretty good at recovering.
Okay. So. Yeah. I hope so. I hope that's the case. Yeah, it was hard to look at.
I do know at the Peninsular Station they backed off on the usual spray program because they didn't have fruit to protect anymore on the apples and the grapes.
Okay, we don't spray these trees. They're planted. I mean, they're eating apples, but we planted them primarily for wildlife.
You might very well get away without spraying. You know, they just did because we had research going on there and they had the product available. But I think the prognosis is probably pretty good.
All right, good to hear. Thank you. I appreciate it. Have a good week.
You as well. Thanks, Jim. Boy, there's lots of work going on our Facebook page here. We've had many, many posts, and there's a dandy photo here that I wanted to mention. Rick sent us of cedar apple rust on crabs, and Pat, that's a really good, if you want to know what cedar apple rust looks like, go to our Facebook page and you're going to see it, right?
Yeah, and that might actually be, there's a few different rust species. That might be hawthorn rust, which tends to go to the fruit more than cedar apple rust does. But it's a spectacular looking disease. If you do go to the Facebook page, I think it's remarkable that what we have there are three fruits and one is covered with the rust disease and looks like something from outer space, and then two nearby fruits look perfectly healthy. I don't really know how to explain that phenomenon, but
pretty interesting.
But, yeah, that's a beautiful photo.
And we have, we've got some examples somewhere also on Facebook of the espalier method of growing. And I'm, of course, right now when I'm trying to find it, I think it's under visitor posts, under our comments section, which is kind of in the middle of the page. We'll get to that in a minute, but I wanted to also take us to another shot here, which is really a cool shot from Rick. Came across some doll's eyes earlier this week in the Menominee area. Can you elaborate on doll's eyes? And they are really, that's a really pretty plant, isn't it? It's sort of a deep red stem with white eyes, well, with white little marble-type berries, I guess, or flowers with a little dot in them. So they do look like doll's eyes. And I have no idea what the proper name for them is. We'll ponder on that for a minute, because I wanted to also bring up, maybe you guys can think about that while I talk about Peggy and Fort Atkinson. And Amaya, this may be something for you. She says that her red raspberry canes were stunted this year and they didn't produce well. Wondering what she can do to protect that so it doesn't happen again. I imagine it could be any number of issues, or maybe Pat has a better idea on what that might be.
Yeah, I would definitely take a look at the soil. That's the usual problem of stunting with raspberries, is if they're in a heavy soil or if there was too much water. The disease Phytophthora that we mentioned earlier for blueberry also goes to raspberry. Pretty much any plant can be affected by Phytophthora. So these fruit plants do not like wet feet. And so with all the rain we've had, I would definitely consider that. I don't know if there's other.
All right. Well, that's, I think you're right. Andy in Steuben has something for us. Let's just go there. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Well, we got a few black walnut trees on our property. We just bought this place a while ago, and I'm thinking of harvesting them. If people do that, they're just starting to drop off the tree, and I'm wondering, are there any ideas about, is it possible?
Yeah,
it is possible. I would recommend you to wear heavy-duty rubber gloves.
Right, because of the staining.
Yeah, and so one of the things that you can do is just you can remove the green husk.
Okay.
And then just let them dry.
Okay.
And once they're dry, you just can open them with, you know, just a hammer, or you can buy one of those nut openers.
Okay.
And then you can just eat them. Another thing that I think that you can also do that I've heard, but I will research it a little bit more. I think that you can blanch them. So you pick them and then you put them in boiling water for, like, you know, something like 30 seconds.
Okay.
And then you'll remove, like, the green husk. And then again, you let it dry and then you just open them once they're dry.
And hide them from the squirrels.
Yes.
My mother used to do this every year and just put them in a bushel basket out in the garage. And the family ever ate one. The squirrels were well fed. So
when you're talking about blanching them, would they have the green removed from them, the husk?
No, you blanch them with the husk, I think, and that's for actually to remove it.
Oh,
it's easier to remove.
If you pick them from the floor, it's easier to just hand remove it.
Right.
But if you're just harvesting from the tree, then you probably it might be easy to blanch them.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I can tell you what, have a good pick, Andy. I remember as a kid having to pick the nuts from black walnuts, and it's a pretty picky process, I can tell you that. They're great once you have them, have that fruit, but it's hard.
I can tell you my experience with black walnuts. I didn't know what a black walnut was. I've never seen one, and I planted my vegetable garden under one.
Oh, well, that you learned a lesson.
Yes.
There. That's forever lasting.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness! Because you're not going to have any good tomatoes or any of the Solanese plants.
But black-eyed Susan and Monarda grow like weeds under it. That's my experience. So.
Well, here again, if you go under, go to our Facebook page and go under listener posts and comments, there are several photos of the espalier method of raising your fruit trees. And then we had something from Sherry here. And I think, Pat, this is probably for you. This is an apple that looks awful.
Yeah, it looks definitely has a bad case of apple scab. And apple scab, if people go to the Facebook page, it sometimes the lesions are large and contiguous like that. Other times it's individual spots. But there is a publication that if you Google, you can find. It's called Diagnosing Apple Problems During Fall Harvest Season. And it's not on our Learning Store website, but it is on the fruit website. It is in the process of being revised, and so we will be having an updated version of it. But for now, if you just
go to that
do a search, you'll find pictures of scab and some of the insect problems that can cause all sorts of problems late in the season.
Let's go to Zach in Milwaukee next. Zach, what's on your mind?
Hey, guys. So this late spring, I purchased a fig tree that was potted and a bare root peach tree. And I potted them up into like 3-gallon pots, and they've been doing really well. But I'm still not
sure if I want to plant them outside, so I'm going to keep them potted at least till next year. And I was just wondering kind of how I should handle that over the next few months, like when I should bring them inside, or should I just keep them in the garage? Or
the fig tree, you should bring it inside earlier. As soon as you have the first frost, I would bring it in, or possibly even before that, because it's not cold hardy, so it's going to get damaged. The peach tree, you can leave it for longer and wait until it drops all the leaves and go into dormancy, and then you can put it in your garage. Would be fine anywhere where it's, you know, relatively warm. It's not exposed to a lot of changes in temperature. You don't want to bring it inside, because then you're going to have a hard time for it going into dormancy. It's going to keep growing if you bring it now. But you can go step by step and just wait outside during the fall, drops all the leaves, and then move it in to a place where it's still exposed to winter temperature, but not extreme cold winter temperatures.
Okay, so with the fig, is it's a Chicago hardy, so it's about the most cold, yeah, party of,
okay,
the figs?
If that's the case, I would do the same thing as the peach tree. Just let them acclimate. The problem is that when you have them on a pot, it has, those roots are going to be much more susceptible to the cold, because the pot is going to get cold faster. You don't have the entire volume of soil surrounding it. So I would be concerned of problems with the root system, cold damage to the root system. That's the only reason why I would bring them in to sort of like a more protected winter environment.
All right.
Okay. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot for calling. Let's go back to Facebook for a minute. Sherry has posted a shot of one of her grape leaves and wondering what is attacking. Looks like it may be some sort of insect issue. What do you think, Christelle Godeau?
So I can't see the picture really well, and my big question would be, is it widespread or is it just on one leaf? Most likely, it's grape phylloxera. That's what causes those galls. There are other like midges or little flies that can cause galls too. So it would be better to see it on like how widespread it is and exactly look at the galls. But the likelihood of it being phylloxera is much higher, because those midges are very few and far between and never cause significant problems. Grape phylloxera is well established here. It's actually from here. So it's most likely what it is. And it's tiny insects that will cause galls on the leaves and on the roots. And there are things you can do, but if it's just a little bit like that, a few galls like this, it's not a big issue. You can just prune off those leaves and it won't be a problem, because it doesn't affect the plant per se. It just will, if there's high infestations, then you can lose the leaf as it crinkles around those galls. But otherwise, it's not a huge problem, and I would just prune those off and then
go
keep
from
going.
There.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, the music tells me that we're about out of time. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today, and I hope you'll come back and do it again. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Amaya Atucha, Patricia McManus, and Christelle Godeau, all from the University of Wisconsin and their respective departments of horticulture, plant pathology, and entomology. We'll get them back and we'll do this again. I think it was a lot of fun, and I learned something. I bet you did as well. Thank you for listening. Monday, our physical therapist will be in to talk about paint-related fear. Wow. Hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.